Sir, the possibility of successfully navigating an asteroid field is approximately 3,720 to 1.
Never tell me the odds.
I'm Pete Mitchell. He's Peyton Jones. And this is the Church Planner Podcast.
Welcome back to the Church Planner Podcast. Peyton Jones here, and I am here today with Eric Geiger. Some of you know him. He is the pastor of Mariners Church in Southern California. He also has written quite a few books, but he's got one today that we're going to talk about called The Rooted Leader. So, Eric, welcome.
Peyton, thanks for having me. It's an honor to be on.
Yes, nice to have you. You know, I'll be honest, a Church Planner Podcast, we're not that fancy. So we don't get big names on here very often. In fact, the one time we did get your associate, Ed Stetzer, at the end of it, he asked, so are you like two guys that just hang out in mom's basement and drink beers?
He's very kind and gracious, you know.
Well, and you know Broderson down the road from you, right?
Brian's awesome, man. I'm so thankful for him. He's been a great encouragement.
He's an amazing dude. Yeah, I came from Calvary Chapel originally. So
from the one in Costa Mesa?
I got saved there. Sweet. And then I was at Refuge Huntington Beach for a number of years.
Oh, sweet.
And then got sent out by Bill Welsh to the mission field. But hey, enough about me. Let's talk about this book, The Rooted Leader. First off, Eric, thanks for writing it. But what was the inspiration?
The book ended up being the end of a journey that I was with on. I was on with our church and also our pastor. So I taught through the book of Nehemiah about a year ago. And I had marketplace leaders in our church who they felt so encouraged that Nehemiah had so much to do with their work on Monday through Friday. It's almost like Nehemiah became their guy. And they, you know, these are God-fearing, awesome people, but sometimes they can wonder if in the marketplace, if I haven't fed them well, that their faith really integrates to every aspect of their life and that God sent them into the marketplace. They can sometimes wonder if the meeting on Monday morning is holy. And walking through Nehemiah was really encouraging, invigorating for them. I heard more feedback from marketplace leaders during that teaching series than any other series that I've done. At the same time, I brought all of our pastoral team from all of our congregations through the book of Nehemiah over a year. And so in that period, developed frameworks and tools that would help them lead themselves better, but also lead their teams better. And that then, all of that could together ended up becoming the book. So it's not like this weekend I launch a teaching series on The Rooted Leader. That was a long time ago, or over a year ago. And then the same with our pastor. So this is like the end of a lot of testing this out, a lot of working out the principles with both ministry leaders and marketplace leaders.
I love it. Yeah, it's funny how sometimes you write out of that sense of, okay, this is really impacting people. Like, I'm guessing you were a little surprised, like, as you said, like the marketplace leaders, yes, all these people connecting. How did you personally connect with Nehemiah, like, during this whole journey? Like how did, because I'm sure you preach through, you're like a preacher. You're at Mariners Church. Yeah. Most of our leaders probably don't know that's a big church, right? Exponential used to host our conference there. Yeah. It's a big, like, you're obviously a great teacher, but did you feel like you grew personally, like almost like you became buds with Nehemiah?
Yeah, exactly. I feel like Nehemiah and I have spent a lot of time together, and not only in the last year, but before that, in all my years of leading, both in ministry, but also I had a leading in the marketplace season. Nehemiah was always a huge encouragement to me. I remember thinking, man, it'd be so awesome if I could have breakfast with Nehemiah. And then the Spirit just kind of, you know, hitting me that you got better than that. You have his journal. And it's not only his journal, it's one of the 66 books in the Bible. And yes, it shows the whole story of God, that God is faithful to his promises to move people back to the land. And so I don't want to miss the whole story of the Bible in Nehemiah. But then at the same time, it's also his leadership journal. So there's such insight on how to lead. I think this time, this journey over the last 2 years of really spending a lot of time with Nehemiah, the 13th chapter was probably the one that impacted me the most. Mm-hmm. And it's the chapter that's been written about the least, because really, Peyton, people wrestle a bit with the chapter 13 because Nehemiah kind of comes off like a failure. And for me, that is so the reality of being a church ministry leader.
Wow.
I often feel like a failure, you know? I have to preach to myself that I'm not, that I'm already approved by Him, that my identity is secure. I mean, you know, the listener knows that even on your best days in ministry, there's always something, there's always another trial. You're carrying both at the same time, even on your best days. So chapter 13, Nehemiah goes back to Artaxerxes in Persia because he promised him he would. He keeps his promise. And then he comes back to Jerusalem. And the people had promised three things before he left. We'll honor the Sabbath. We'll not intermarry. And that was not a racial decision. It was a religious one not to import little g gods into Jerusalem. And we'll give to the temple. And when Nehemiah comes back, they have broken all three of their promises.
Mm.
It's like he rebuilt a wall in 52 days. He repopulated a city. But he's unable to get the people to really keep their commitments, which then points us to our need for Jesus. But from a leadership standpoint, it's like it's very much the reality of things don't, even everything you hope doesn't happen, you know? And even when things are great, there's things that are challenging. And so I love chapter 13. I love seeing how Nehemiah responds. He addresses each situation, but he also prays and he rests in God, and he ends the book just resting in God. So chapter 13, while I think people skip over it sometimes because you kind of got to wrestle with, oh man, did he fail? And I don't believe he failed at all. I've been to Jerusalem. I know the wall around it now is different than the wall that was there. But many believe the footprint, the ideation of the wall happened when Nehemiah did so, you know, 400 plus years before Jesus arrived. So he's not a failure at all in my mind, but chapter 13 reads like the challenges of ministry leadership. And I would say probably of church planning, where it feels like you're losing every day.
Brother, as a guy that's been a serial planner and handed off many churches, going back sometimes is not pretty, right? Like, I so relate to what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Now, I've never dragged anyone out by their hair.
Yeah, like, yeah. There wasn't an HR team there, you know. That's a text you got to wrestle with.
Yeah, I wanted to.
Yeah, totally. We all get what Nehemiah's feeling.
That's my guy right there, Eric. That's my guy. But I love that because, you know, it's one of the things where Nehemiah was a guy like us. Mm-hmm. Like that's, you know, from the very opening where he has that moment of panic and he's like, Lord, you gotta, you know, why is your face so drawn? And he's like, Lord. So what are some areas like that you feel for leaders in particular that makes Nehemiah, because I know that's what you let out with.
Like, yeah.
Most of us don't think of him like, hey, he's a, but now you've got these leaders, not just in the church, but out in the marketplace. There's something about him that's resonating with them. How would you define that? What is it they're connecting with in him?
The burden that he has combined with the clarity that he provides. So just to apply it to church planners, who I know is the primary audience of the podcast, the pressure that a church planner sometimes feels that they have to come up with this really sticky vision statement that can be on a brochure because a donor is going to ask them, what's your vision? Or someone you're trying to recruit to the team, what's your vision? The word vision can become almost burdensome for a leader. Like, where do I get it from? Do I just go to some other website and copy and paste it? Nehemiah's vision was really simple. That's in chapter 2. Come, let us rebuild the wall so we will no longer be in disgrace. So it's a really simple vision. But that's like, I think it's verse 17 in chapter 2. But before you get there, there's chapter 1 and the beginning of chapter 2. And that's the messy part. That's the overwhelming burden for a city he's never been to, Jerusalem. Though he's Jewish, grew up in Persia, was promoted to the cupbearer position, which is essentially like a chief of staff. So he wasn't in a menial position. He was able to ask for resources from Artaxerxes. And so you could almost look at this from a planning perspective. He had clarity on the resources he needed. He had clarity of where he was to go, Jerusalem. He had clarity on why he was to be there. The walls are in disgrace. All of that, a deep burden from God, but yet simultaneous connected to a belief that this can happen because God had promised to restore the people. So he held both at the same time. And I think that's what resonates with Christian leaders, both in ministry and marketplace. We actually, our faith allows us to hold both at the same time, a burden for a city and belief that God can do immeasurably more than we can ask or imagine, a burden that sin has messed everything up, and a belief that one day God's going to make everything brand new. So we're able to hold both of those at the same time.
Interesting. Well, you mentioned seven rhythms, credibility being one of them, which is probably like the hardest thing to build and the easiest thing to lose.
Very true.
Right?
Very true.
Within a second. But you talk about seven rhythms total. It's you've got character, commitment, competence, chemistry, capacity. But on credibility, why is that so important for a leader?
Well, you really can't lead without credibility. And to quote Aristotle, this was about communication, but it's the same principle because it's about influencing people. Aristotle believed that for you to be an effective communicator, you have to have ethos, pathos, and logos. Ethos being credibility, pathos being passion, logos being logic. The reality is, I'm going to teach this weekend. I can look at my message right now and I can intensify the logic and I can ramp up the passion. I cannot quickly address a credibility gap. I can't. And so if I don't have credibility with you, you won't. It doesn't matter my logic or my passion. So it's to your point when you said at the beginning of this bit of the conversation about credibility, it's built over time but can be lost really quickly. So it's so important and because without credibility, people won't follow. They won't listen. And that doesn't mean you have to be credible in every aspect of your job. It doesn't mean being omnicompetent. Right. But it means being credible in your character, someone that's trusted. It's someone who's trusted.
Yeah, that's good. Oh, okay, so I'm going to hit you with a two-pronged attack on this.
Come on.
Number one, how do you see Nehemiah building credibility in his ministry? And then I kind of want to take a second one, which is how did Eric Geiger, how have you built credibility in your ministry? So so two-prong attack, one just personal wisdom, the other one, what did you learn from Nehemiah on it?
Nehemiah, for sure, a man of character. You see a thread that you could trace throughout the entire book, all 13 chapters, is prayer. You see him praying continually. When he's overwhelmed about the news of the wall, he prays. The prayer and the time he has with God, I believe, forms him into a wise and patient man. So he waits to the right time to talk to Artaxerxes. So he carries the burden for many months. And then when Artaxerxes says, hey, you look sad. I've never seen you sad before, which is also a statement. I mean, this is huge. Artaxerxes says, the text says that Nehemiah was never sad before in his presence. So he wasn't the mopey around the office guy. He wasn't the guy sending off signals like something's wrong, ask me what's wrong. He was always the faith-filled, optimistic, and he's working for a Persian king. I mean, someone who's not of the people of God. But when he's asked, so he's waited all these months, he's been praying, he's got this burden. He has clarity. So clearly he's got some character with Artaxerxes that he trusts him, because a cupbearer role means that you're drinking the cup before the king does. And I mean, if you want to take out a king, all you got to do is get the cupbearer to want to take out the king. So the cupbearer is trusted. Nehemiah is trusted by the king. He also displays competence in knowing exactly what to ask for. Then when he gets to Jerusalem in chapter 2, I'm imagining that he's got immediate credibility with people because he left everything to come there. So he was in a very posh role. He was in a palace in Susa, which was the winter place of the Persian kingdom. And, I mean, he really had a really comfortable life. He left everything to go pursue this vision of rebuilding the wall for God's people. So the credibility, I believe, among the people that said, let's do it, let's put our hand to the task, is because they saw a leader who got his hands dirty, who was willing to sacrifice, who was willing to leave everything to come serve them. who clearly had some credibility with the Persian king because he comes with these resources. So that's what I see in the text about Nehemiah's credibility.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah.
Let me rephrase my, you know, Eric Geiger personal wisdom question. Let me flip it around where not so much how you've built, but let me ask you, when you see a young leader coming up, how do they build credibility with you?
It's good. That's great. So character is for sure part of it. But in that chapter, we talk about, or I talk about character, competence, chemistry, capacity. And so how a leader builds credibility is they walk with integrity. I'm talking about a young leader building credibility with me. They walk with integrity. They do what they say they're going to do. When they say they're going to do it, they have commitment to the team. They display the values that we champion. These values are in this person. Mm. And then capacity is a big one. It's when a person is able to take on more than they think they can take on and learn some new skills to then the more becomes normal. And then that's they settle in for a season, they take on a new responsibility, and the more becomes normal. Wow. Capacity to me is big. Otherwise, we're going to have a team of people that isn't prepared for what's next. So the ability to take on new responsibilities and not be crushed is huge. It's actually how a young leader is developed. So I'll give away an interview question that I don't directly interview that many people anymore. But when I did, I would ask, man, tell me about the last time that you were completely overwhelmed. What did you do in your role? And not with life. I realize life's part of it, but I have that happen. But in your role, tell me the last time and what did you do? If someone articulates, well, I went to my supervisor and I asked for the work to be redistributed, or, you know, I needed to take more. I almost burned out, so I took time off. I appreciate the honesty, and but that's not the answer I'm looking for. What I'm looking for, if I'm looking for capacity, is someone who says, I looked at everything I was doing and I eliminated the most fruitful things so I could create more space for things that are more fruitful. Or I developed a new volunteer team. Or I figured out how to learn this skill that I didn't learn before, which created 10% more time of margin for me, and I used that time towards this new initiative. I'm looking for things that shows that they can handle more without being crushed. And it's really how if you ever exercise in the gym, if you want to increase your bench press or your shoulder press or your squat, whatever it is, you got to put more weight on the bar than you had last time. The trick is to not put so much weight that you get crushed, but enough extra weight that muscles grow.
Yeah. Okay, you're speaking to my pain point. I just started back at the gym.
Come on.
Doing for home, so I'm with you, brother. I'm with you.
Man, the older we get, the more. I'm not saying you're old. I'm saying I'm old. The older I get, the more it's important.
I talk about it on this podcast all the time. I'm going with the struggle, Eric.
I know. I'm fighting it, man.
So out of those seven rhythms, what are the ones, speaking of struggle, what are the ones you see leaders today in our current culture struggling with the most?
Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's conviction. So conviction is the fruit on the surface. Beneath the surface is clarity and courage. Some leaders wrestle with clarity. They wrestle articulating, here's what we believe. I'm speaking to church ministry leaders and church planners right now. The world's asking for clarity on important doctrinal positions and what do we really believe and what is the Jude 3, the faith handed down once and for all to the saints. So some leaders, and when I say they wrestle with clarity, for some, there's marbles in their mouth. Like when they talk about something, I'm not even sure they really believe it.
Yeah.
Some have clarity and wrestle with courage. They're like, I don't know if I want to say that. That will offend someone. So conviction is when clarity and courage really meet. So for some leaders, that's a conviction is a struggle. For other leaders, it's not at all. Like I've got both. I've got clarity and courage, and discouragement's a struggle. So the fruit of perseverance. There's a, you know, there's a chapter that's just stunning to me in Nehemiah's journal where people are trying to get him to stop building. They're threatening attacks. They're threatening his life. They're saying we're gonna have all these people who are surrounding you attack your people. And so Nehemiah, he's got this beautiful tension in that chapter where he says to the people, fight for your families, mm-hmm. fight for your lives, your sons and your daughters and your wives. And then at the end of the chapter, he says, our God is fighting for us. So it's fight, but also you can rest that God is fighting for you. And that's probably the one, Peyton, that there's times where I'm like, what am I doing? I want to do something else. And fight. But you can rest that God is fighting for you is the inspiration I get from Nehemiah.
That's really good. I love that as you're talking about that, Eric. I'm hearing that it's not always easy. In fact,
no.
Very hard to lead. And when you said conviction, my mind's immediately just going back to just he's not going to be deterred. He's got this confidence,
right,
as you said, not only in the Lord, but in knowing what he's got to do. And I want to just, you know, I know, Eric, that you have worked with a ton of leaders. So I'm going to go off road here for a second and ask, sometimes in a leader, when they have that conviction and they just know what they're supposed to do,
right,
you imagine how difficult it was to rally all these people in the threat of like Sanballat and Tobiah. And, you know, when you're around a leader like that, is there ever a time where it's a little, I know it's inspiring at times, is there a time where it's a little unnerving to be around leaders that have that conviction, like they just know where they're going? And what advice would you give to a leader who has that kind of vision, has that kind of conviction, is rallying a church, a congregation, a church plant, so they don't freak people out at the same time?
Yeah, I mean, there's conviction, but it's not listed as a fruit of the Spirit. We hold up conviction, and I think it's a great attribute of leaders and of all Christians that we're clear on what we believe and we have courage. But if you have conviction apart from the Spirit or apart from the fruit of the Spirit, you'll intimidate people in a bad way. Not you know, there's intimidating that's good. And I don't mean like you try to be intimidating, but sometimes if I'm around someone who has such faith, I can be intimidated in an inspiring way. Like, man, I want to spend more time with Jesus like this person does. Yes. I want to believe like this person does. That's a disorienting, godly disorientation. You know, I want that. But then there's the intimidating in a bad way where you run people over, mm-hmm. where if your vision feels disconnected from their reality or their pain, it feels as if you are only focused on the task and you're not pastoring people or caring for people or respecting others or honoring others. That kind of conviction is ruined by, it's not the conviction that's wrong, it's the conviction, it's the lack of the Spirit surrounding the conviction that ruins the conviction.
No, it makes sense. I mean, when I think about all of this, I would imagine that the Apostle Paul, I mean, I know Jesus, half the stuff he told the disciples are going to do, they're like, what's he talking about?
Right?
No, you're going to go into all the villages. And they're like, but he was so confident, right? Yeah. You'll do greater things like Paul, right? No, we have to do this, guys. We've got to go here. John Wesley, how did he inspire a generation of circuit riders? I mean, I see Nehemiah and his kind of almost like it's a bullheadedness, isn't it? Like certain leaders have a bull, like Nehemiah's kind of bullheaded yet sensitive, right? But there is a way like where I'm just saying like there are people that have accomplished great things like Nehemiah and it's not listed as a spiritual gift, but it seems like they have like the Holy Spirit in them inspires. It's not a cattle driver. It's like a shepherd where they lead out in front and people just want to follow them.
Yeah. And their grit, their perseverance is inspiring. Like this person's not going to stop, so I'm going to join them.
You know, that's it, right? Yeah. It's like Rocky where he's running through the streets at the beginning by himself and you feel all sorry. At the end, the whole city of Philadelphia is running behind him, right? Because they're so inspired by his fight.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, I dig it. All right. Well, okay. So listener, one of the things that you may not know about Eric and Mariners Church is it's the home of the Rooted Network. And all church planters everywhere, I think, know the Rooted curriculum. The tools came originally from Africa, so you know it's got credibility, what we're talking about earlier. But Eric, has anything that you've seen God doing through the Rooted Network, has there been a crossover between what you learned in this book, The Rooted Leader, and how you've seen the Rooted Network and people just rising up and grabbing hold of this?
Yeah. Rooted Network is, to your points, essentially the publishing company that we have as a church. And we serve, gosh, maybe 5,000 churches currently with discipleship resources, Rooted being the 10-week experience that helps a church disciple their people, but also get them into ongoing groups. We do it 3 times a year here at Mariners. We just started Rooted this week. So we've got a bunch of new people in groups, and it's so fun to see it happen.
So cool.
The Rooted Leader then became, there's a connection in that the rhythms of discipleship don't end when somebody becomes a leader. We don't view leadership as disconnected from discipleship.
Right.
So we want the rhythm of prayer and repentance. There's an appendix in the Rooted Leader that connects the rhythms in Rooted to the Rooted Leader. But I would say it's not an overflow, not a companion resource to Rooted.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, that's awesome, man. Is there anything else before we go today that you would like to say about the Rooted Leader to anyone listening?
I just want to say that I'm really thankful for the church planters, for the faith that they have I really believe to be a lot like Nehemiah, to have a burden for a city, to go plant in that city, to rally a team of people, to coordinate them. That the third chapter in Nehemiah is so wild to me because it's this long chapter of all the people that are working on the wall and how coordinated they are. And Nehemiah knows their names and knows what they did. That's a church planner. You know, you got a team of 34 people and you know them, and this thing's not happening without them, and you're in it with them. I think it's beautiful what church planners do.
That's awesome, Eric. And, you know, I mean, just hearing you say that, you get it. Let me ask you, because I don't know much about your history or story. Did you go through the suck that is church planning once upon a time?
I
say that with affection.
That's funny. I have been a part of launching a lot of congregations. And so I was at a church in Miami as executive and teaching pastor, and we had multiple congregations similar in South Florida to here in Southern California. Launching congregations in some ways is similar to church planning.
It is.
In other ways, it's not, because often the church planner has to do a whole lot of resource fundraising, and how we do it, we take that burden off of the organization or the system as a whole, or the church as a whole, finances, as opposed to the planner having to do so much fundraising. I have a senior pastor vision fund, which I'm so thankful for the elders give me, where I have to inform them how I spend it. But we looked recently, I've been here 8 years, and I've only spent it on church plants. So it's people that I know from, so I'm not doing this as an advertisement, like, hey, email me, and I'll give you money. These are people.
Yeah, they will. Yeah. This audience will.
And I don't blame them because that's what a church planter does. And I'm never offended when someone asks, but the people that I have allocated those resources to are people from my past who have, who I was on a team with and planted a church in Boston or planted a church in Miami or Canada, you know, and we've supported them. I honestly think what I do is easier than what a church planter does. So, you know, sometimes people would look at the size of Mariners and say, man, that must be challenging. Man, motivating a team to set up in a school at 4:30 in the morning and then going to the bathroom, put on a different shirt and preaching.
Yeah.
And then run into the lobby and meeting every first time guest. And then on Monday, forming an email to send to your seven partner churches because they want to be able to tell their missions committee how the money they gave them. And then trying to figure out a nice way to tell them that you can't entertain their junior high mission trip group in July, because even though it would be awesome for the partnership, it's really not going to really be that fruitful for the church plant. You know, so I know all those stories.
Yeah, you do, brother. I mean, I'm just listening to you talk to Lord, I'm like, he gets it. And I think that's important too, is in order to send well, you have to understand it. And you speak, Eric, like someone who has sent well.
Yeah.
And that's its own skill. I mean, years ago, we used to work with church pastors to send well. I would say most of the planners, they knew what they were about. And of course, you know, the ones that are truly called to it, they're going to be okay.
Yeah.
But sending well is a skill in itself. So
I'm curious,
I appreciate that.
The guys that you work with in the network, most of who are listening now, how many organizations or churches what would be the norm in terms of partners that they have that are resourcing them the first 3 years?
Yeah, I would say on average, they are, you probably have heard this before, NASCAR.
I've heard
it. Yep.
They got a whole bunch of logos on the car. Yeah.
Yep. That's it. And you know, networks used to discourage that. Back when I was on staff at NAM, they would say, hey, no, you can't do Acts 29 and NAM.
Yeah.
And people have reasons for saying that, but that has actually started to lessen over time because, you know, whereas NAM is really strong on training, you know, Acts 29 might be really good on community. And so people are starting to realize that, this network over here may be really good on coaching, or this one might be good on funding. And so I think there's been a real development in partnership together, in answer to your question. As far as how many, I think it depends on the moxie of the planter and how much hustle they've got to go out and build those relationships. I do think it's encouraging because I think I'll just step aside for a second and just say over the years, there was a sense of let's throw money at a church planter. And that's starting to change. They're starting to realize that maybe wasn't the best investment of kingdom dollars, where instead maybe it's something else that they need. And so the coaching, a lot of what you're talking about in Nehemiah, where he knew their names, that relational leadership, the reason you said the guys I send out, I know them.
Yeah.
I think we're returning to a more healthy model that's actually more New Testament. That, hey, Timothy, my true son, Titus, these are people they knew. And I would personally love to see it be less mercenary and more relational by nature.
What caused the evaluation of the model? Was it just a whole lot of money was spent and people start saying, man, how effective are we really?
Yeah. I could, if maybe offline, I could really answer some of that question a bit, but I think it's wise. And the other thing that I think people are starting to do, because over the years I've been able to kind of coach and counsel with networks and denominations, I've always advocated for a milestone type of funding, that when you hit this milestone, it goes up, right? And then when you hit that second milestone, the funding goes up. You might have a total amount, but it's gated behind certain metrics and milestones. Because otherwise, if you know how it is, right? If you just tell someone, hey, you know, I'm going to pay you $3,000 a month to, you know, this idea, but no metrics, no results. Then you are wasting money. I mean, that'd be the true if I just hired an employee or even told my teenage daughter, hey, I'll just give you this much money for you to have generic job.
Right.
So it's one of those things that I think people are learning, but protecting those kingdom investments, I think it's good stewardship. And planners out there, you know, you guys know, because the ones that hustle out there, it drives them nuts. Wait, this guy got $1 million, but you know, he's not doing anything.
And what's he doing? Yeah.
Yeah. So we've seen lots of that, the guts and the glory. But hey, guys, my guest today has been Eric Geiger. You guys know Rooted Network, like we said earlier. You should know this book, The Rooted Leader. If they want to get in touch with you, Eric, or even go deeper, are there resources or places they can go to learn more today about The Rooted Leader?
Yeah, you can buy the book on any place where books are sold. I think it's on Barnes & Noble, Amazon, all those, you know, and
nice.
Then Christian websites too. But and then I have some additional articles and things I've written on ericgeiger.com as
nice.
Well.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right. Well, guys, again, my guest has been Eric Geiger, his book, The Rooted Leader. This has been the Church Planter Podcast. Peyton Jones, want to thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.